This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you for coming. Tonight, we have the pleasure of hearing Dr. Schwartz speak to us tonight. Dr. Schwartz is actually an assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases right here at UCSF. He actually did his undergrad at the University of Michigan in the degree of Biological Anthropology. He then did his medical school at Rush Medical School in Chicago. That was followed up by doing a residency in internal medicine at Mass General Hospital. That's the other general hospital in Boston. He then came back and did a fellowship in infectious diseases right here at UCSF, for which he's also currently the program director. His current activities also include, alongside his work as an infectious diseases specialist, also working on the inpatient infectious disease consultations service. He's also part of the infectious diseases faculty practice, as well as a UCSF travel medicine immunization clinic. His clinical and research interests include the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of infections in the immunocompromised patient population. In areas of teaching, he actually runs a section at the School of Medicine in the area of infection, immunity, and inflammation. He also serves on the Education Committee for the Infectious Diseases Society of America. And to prove that he's really good at this, he received an award in the Halle DeBaz Academy of Educators, which is actually a big honor for a lot of us educators here at UCSF. On the national level, he served on the guideline committee to create recommendations for the management of Chagas disease and tuberculosis in transplant recipients. He's also a contributing editor to the Sanford Guide of Antimicrobial Therapy, which I can attest as a medical doctor and among my peers. This is the Biblehood to doctorship. We all have one in our pocket, and mine's outdated, by the way. Can you get me a new one? Okay. Yeah. All right, so let's welcome Dr. Schwartz to our Medical Detective Series, who's here to talk to us about detecting infections from abroad.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here tonight and be able to speak with you. I will start off by saying that I know probably a lot of you do international travel or hoping to do international travel in the near future, and it's generally very safe. And I think it's an outstanding experience and something everybody should do if they can. Obviously, for my talk and talking about this medical detective series, I'm going to kind of show you the less common things that happen to people. So I don't want you to walk away saying, I don't want to go anywhere outside my house, or I don't want to travel to the developing country, because I really think it is important for people to see other parts of the world. So please think about that as I move forward. I have no disclosures. So to start off, just to give you a background of international travel. This is some data from 2010. There were nearly 1 billion people traveling, crossing international borders. And if you looked at travelers from the U.S., there were 60 million, and about half of them were going to developing countries. And the reason I focus on developing parts of the world is that's where a lot of the risks that I'm going to talk about and some of these infections are more common. If you look at some of the data that looks at projection of future travel, you can see there's like a projected continued exponential increase in the number of people that are going to be going crossing international borders, and a lot of it's going to be more to developing parts of the world. So if we're going to have a medical talk about this, there has to be some sort of medical conditions that happen to people. So if you look at what happens to people when they travel, about half of them will report some type of illness, and we'll talk about this more, most commonly diarrhea. 1 to 5% will actually require medical attention during their travel. 3% report fevers, and 1 in 1,000 to 10,000 will actually require medical evacuation for one reason or another. And 1 in 1,000 die during travel to a developing country, but it doesn't necessarily, in most cases, really related to the travel itself, and I'll explain to you why. So if you look at the data here, this is published a while ago in an emergency medicine journal, but it looked at what were the causes of death in travelers who were going to developing countries from the U.S. And what I can show you here is that it's actually cardiovascular disease, which is, you know, one of the most common causes of death here in the U.S., and that's what's going on in a lot of these travelers. So I always kind of start by showing this to reinforce everybody that if you're going to travel, make sure you're healthy for your own and have all your medical conditions that are not related to travel taken care of before you go on a journey, no matter where it is. Although a lot of what I'm going to talk about is infection, you can see infection is an extremely uncommon cause of death in travelers, and that's why I said I don't want to scare anybody. If you look at preventable causes of death in U.S. travelers, and this is data that I was able to just pull off the U.S. State Department website, that you can see that vehicular accidents were actually the most common preventable cause of death in travelers, followed by homicide. And what this makes me want to remind everybody is that buckle your seatbelt if you're taking children, put them in car seats, and that it's these types of common things that you can hopefully prevent when you're traveling that you really need to worry about. When you think about things like homicide, it's usually more like robberies and things like that, and reminding people that, you know, you shouldn't go out at night by yourself. If somebody wants your wallet, give it to them, etc. So those are the types of things that I think it's always worth thinking about when you travel to any part of the world. Now, kind of moving on to more of illness, and we'll talk more about infection. This is a study that there's this huge consortium. It's called the GeoSentinel Survey. And this is hundreds of different sites all across the world that collect data on returning travelers and identify illness in them. And if you look at what were the most common cause of illness in returning travelers, dermatological conditions, so skin conditions, febrile illness, or gastrointestinal complaints were the three most common things that were seen. And we're going to spend most of our time talking about those three common conditions. So if you look at the top five altogether, fever without localizing findings is really the one that I'm going to start by talking about. And I think it's interesting, and it's going to let us talk about some really interesting diseases. And I can say, as an infectious diseases doctor, this is always something that we get very worried about when we have somebody returning from a developing country who has fever with it. But it's also something that I think a lot of our trainees get very excited about, thinking about all the different possibilities. So when I have a patient who's returning with a fever from developing world, there's really five things that I really start by thinking about. And we'll go into these in a little bit more detail. I first think about where they went, obviously. But when I think about where they went, I think about really specifically, like, what were their destinations? You know, what part of the country, what, you know, because different, you know, each country is not homogeneous. There's a lot of heterogeneity and infection risk. So really kind of pinning down their travel. Incubation period. So I'll show you some other figures that incubation period is quite variable per type of infection. So if somebody has been back for 2 weeks, it's going to exclude several types of common infections. So you really want to think about how long has it been since the last exposure. Then you want to think about what were the exposures, why they were there, were they exposed to animals, were they doing healthcare work, were they exposed to other ill travelers, did they go in fresh water, which has a number of types of infections that we'll talk about. And then do they take prophylaxis or do they take medication to prevent infection? Probably the one that you most commonly have heard about is people will take medication to prevent infection with malaria, and we term that as malaria prophylaxis. Or were they immunized against different types of infections? Were they immunized against things like meningococcus, which causes meningitis, or hepatitis, etc., before they went? So to kind of delve into this a little bit more deeply, first thing, as I said, we think about destination. And this GeoSentinel survey that collects data for many years from all over the world has allowed us to better pinpoint, well, what are the most common types, causes of fever in returning travelers from different parts of the world. And they nicely broke it up by certain areas like the Caribbean, Central America, South America, Sub-Saharan Africa, South Central Asia, and Southeast Asia. And you can see that if you look at any individual place outside sub-Saharan Africa, that dengue fever has become the most common cause of fever in returning traveler. And we'll talk a little bit more about dengue fever in a minute. If you look at sub-Saharan Africa, though, that malaria is the most common cause of fever in a returning traveler. And then there's some other infections that you may have heard about, typhoid, like typhoid Mary. This can be a common cause of fever, and it's more common in South Central Asia, which is more like the Indian subcontinent. Some infections like rickettsia infections, so if you ever heard of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, that's in that same family. And then EBV and CMV, so EBV you guys probably all know about, that's Epstein-Barr virus, which is the virus that causes mononucleosis. So if you ever knew anybody who had mono, that's the infection that they get, but a lot of people pick it up following travel. So that same data set was used to help kind of distinguish destination, but now looking at incubation period as well. So if you think about these different types of infection, some of them have very short incubation periods, whereas the time from you're getting bitten by a mosquito, for example, with dengue, to the time that you show up with fever is very short. So if you had somebody come back here 2 weeks after returning from travel, after a potential exposure with a fever, it's probably not going to be dengue, and it's probably not going to be some of the common rickettsial infections because their incubation periods are very short. However, if you have somebody present several weeks later, you would think about things like typhoid fever, CMV and EBV, these viruses that can cause mono-like illness, and some other types of malaria. P. falciparum is Plasmodium falciparum, which is a type of malaria. P. vivax is Plasmodium vivax, which is another species of malaria. So then, as I said, I also think about exposures. And when I think about exposures, I think, were they exposed to insects? Since insects are a common vector for many of the infections we worry about, do they have an animal exposure? Animals can carry infections. Animals can also carry insects, which carry infection, which we'll talk about. Fresh water, as I mentioned, so there's a couple common infections, one called schistosomiasis, there's one that's called leptospirosis that people can get from being in fresh water. Were they good about how they ate and drank? Were they drinking bottled water? Were they trying to follow good guidelines in terms of eating safer foods? And are there other ill travelers? I always like to tell a story of I had this returning traveler from India who came back with fever and a rash. And you always think about exotic infections as somebody comes back with fever and a rash. But after we got talking to the patient a little bit further, looked a little bit more at their rash, asked about the people they traveled with, they identified that the person he was traveling with actually had chickenpox. And that's what that, and he had thought he had been vaccinated in the past or had had it as a kid, but in fact we called his mom and he had it, and that's what he had was chickenpox. So it's not always exotic. I mean, still common things happen commonly. They're not always travel related. And sexual activity is an important thing to think about as well. We see returning travelers each year who have new sexual exposures, and we worry about things like gonococcus or Neisseria gonorrhea infection, syphilis, new HIV infection. So how do we use specific symptoms or exam findings to help guide us? Well, there's certain things that are going to be more common in the patient's history or on their exam that's going to point us in one direction or another. And I'm going to touch back on a lot of these diseases, but abdominal pain can be seen in lots of diseases. But for example, typhoid infection tends to have a lot of abdominal pain. Arthralgias, which is kind of pain in your joints, can be very common in chikungunya fever, which is a type of viral infection which has been getting a lot more press recently, and I'm going to show you guys a little bit about it because although it used to live on the other side of the world, it has been coming closer and closer to us in large numbers. Sometimes you'll see rash, and as I said, depending on the type of rash, it's going to help. If it's going to be little tiny fluid-filled blisters, you're going to be worried about chicken pox like in the patient I told you about. But I'm going to show you some other rashes like we see in dengue fever that will make you think otherwise. Jaundice, or when you have yellowing of the skin and eyes, is something you'd see if somebody had hepatitis infection. And then other types of ocular changes we can see. This is somebody with a conjunctival inflammation that in that patient had leptospirosis. And lastly, I think of what kinds of preventative measures. So as I mentioned, which vaccines did they get? Did they get the vaccines appropriately? Certain vaccines, you actually need a shot on day one, and then you need another one 4 weeks later before you get adequate protection. So if they didn't get both, am I still worried about that type of infection because they weren't vaccinated properly? And then I talked about malaria prophylaxis. We'll talk a little bit more about it later, but there's lots of different types of malaria prophylaxis. They have side effects. Not everybody takes it appropriately, and people may still be at risk. So let's talk about a case to start off with. So this is a 29-year-old guy. He returned 4 days ago from a three-week trip to Nicaragua, and he was visiting some extended family there. He complains of high fever and now diffuse myalgia, so muscle aches. And this is what you can see on exam. This is a rash. The normal skin color here are these little spots, but you can see there's all this redness all over them. And we call this a maculopapular rash. So as I said, there's lots of different types of rashes, and the type of rash can help you pick out a disease process. So this was really the most striking finding outside the fever on his exam, was this diffuse maculopapular rash. And then we got laboratory tests on him as well, and he had a low white blood cell count. So for those of you who have some familiarity with the white blood cell count as a marker in a blood test, when we see infection, it usually goes up, okay? So this guy's was low. He also had platelets were low as well. And then he had some evidence of liver inflammation, on some of his lab tests. So this pattern is actually very helpful for us and limits it to certain disease processes. So the combination of the fever, the rash, these lab findings, also the fact that the patient had just returned from Central America, where we know dengue fever is the most common cause of fever in a returning traveler from that area. He also returned just a couple days ago, so we're still probably in a short incubation period, that it helped us kind of figure out that that's probably the most likely diagnosis. And in fact, we got some testing on him afterwards, and that's indeed the infection that he had. So let's talk a little bit about dengue fever, given that it is the most common cause of fever from many parts of the world. There are reported about 100 million cases of dengue fever across the world every year. And that goes with the fact that I told you it's very common. It is transmitted by mosquitoes, and the Aedes albopictus and Aedes aegypti mosquitoes are the two that can transmit it. And opposed to the mosquitoes that transmit malaria, these guys can bite all day long, and whereas the mosquitoes that bite from malaria are usually more at night. And it's often an urban disease. I think a lot of people who travel, they think, well, as long as I stay in big cities, I'm not going to really be at risk for having problems. But what happens is the mosquitoes like to live in these tires where there's standing water. And the mosquitoes, which are frequently in urban areas, and so you can have outbreaks in major cities in many parts of the world. So this is, you can go to this map. This is a map on the CDC website that updates regularly of what, one, you can see the background red is our areas that are at risk for dengue. And each one of these red dots is a reported case. So you can see that, as I mentioned, that Central and South America, but even as close as Mexico and the Caribbean, we've had patients here returning from travel to Mexico and other parts of the Caribbean, Dominican, et cetera, who come back with dengue fever. So it's really not as far away as you think. Southeast Asia and the Indian subcontinent are also very common places to acquire dengue fever. So as I said, very short incubation period. People usually present with very bad headaches, joint and muscle aches, nausea and vomiting, and that rash that I showed you. But I'll actually describe a little bit more detail. Most people do fine. They recover after a short period of time. They feel pretty terrible for a number of days. But a small percentage of people will go on to develop something called dengue hemorrhagic fever or dengue shock syndrome, which is actually an immune response to this infection that can cause you to bleed, to cause further low platelets and bleeding can be very severe. Most people, if they got this type of severe manifestation of it here in the U.S., we could support them in an ICU, give them fluid to resuscitate their blood pressure, etc. But when you get this in a developing country, it can be they may not have the resources to do that. As I said, on the lab testing, you get low white blood count, low platelets, and evidence of liver injury. And to show you a little bit more about the rash, so what happens usually early on is patients will report having like a rash that looks like there's sunburn all over the body. However, it'll be in areas where they know that the sun did not touch, and we call it flushing erythema. Erythema being redness and kind of all over. And usually patients you won't necessarily see them in clinic when they come in with these, but they'll have this redness or sunburn all over, and then they will develop their fever around that same time. And then over a 3 to 5 day period, they'll continue to feel pretty ill, and then they'll go on to develop this other maculopapular rash. And sometimes you can have things called petechiae, which I'm going to see if I... So here, if you guys can see, do you see how this looks a little bit more purpley bluish than the other parts of the rash? Well, that's where blood vessels are broken and there's actually blood under the skin. And that we call petechiae. And that is the rash that you tend to see later. In terms of making a diagnosis, a lot of times the diagnosis is made clinically, but there are some diagnostic tests. And usually what you'll see early on is you will see you could actually see the virus itself. You could detect the virus itself in the blood, but usually it goes away very quickly. And then what the testing that we tend to use are these antibody tests. So our IgM, which is a early antibody response. So your immune system makes antibodies and it makes it two kinds. One is an IgM, which is kind of that it's made very quickly, very early on, not the best at helping you fight the infection, but it's kind of getting out there and doing what it can quickly. And then later on, we tend to see the more specific response, which is an IgG response. And that's how we end up making the diagnosis, is usually we'll test positive by an IgM and IgG shortly afterwards. So how can you treat it? There's really not much in the terms of, that we have treatment. We don't have a lot in terms of antiviral medications altogether. This is a virus, and we do not have a lot of antiviral medications. So treatment is usually supportive, giving fluids, medication to control the fever. But prevention is really what you can do. So when I think about how do I prevent this, you want to avoid endemic areas. So you can go on the CDC website, for example, and a lot of times they'll have information about towns that are having big dengue outbreaks, and you might want to avoid going to that town if you can pick something else on your itinerary. But if you're going to be in an area that's at risk, recommend using agent with a high concentration of DEET. And as I said, I have no disclosure, so I'm not trying to support 3M's product. I'm not getting any money for trying to support Ultrathon. But the reason I like this is because it's a long-acting, slow-release formulation of DEET, and therefore you don't have to put it on as many times a day. So this is a nice agent. There's also something called permethrin, which you don't put on your skin, but you can spray on your clothes. And those two agents can work synergistically to help prevent getting an infection. So I know a lot of people around here like to travel and take holiday in Hawaii. So I did want to say that to show you about an outbreak that happened in Hawaii about a decade ago. So a lot of places in the world have this mosquito that can transmit dengue effectively. In Hawaii, they have an Aedes mosquito. And in 2001, there was a traveler returning from an endemic area with dengue. And at that point, after the mosquito bit that person who was infected, they set up a transmission cycle in Hawaii where this other similar mosquito was able to transmit dengue. And there were actually over 1,000 infections in Hawaii during that period, but their public health group was able to get it under control by really improving their ability to control mosquito exposure. And so this is a reminder, I think, to everybody and to me that our risk for these types of infections are always changing because our environment's always changing, the insect vector locations are changing, and as climate changes, we're going to see things like this in places that we do not now. So I had mentioned big word chikungunya fever earlier, and I would say a couple years ago, I'm not sure that I would include this in a talk to this group, but I do think now what's going on close to us is worth talking about. So chikungunya fever is also transmitted by the Aedes mosquitoes, and infection predominantly has been in Asia and Africa, and you can see here in the green areas is predominantly where the infection has been seen. And this data, these numbers here are probably a little outdated. I put together these slides about a week ago. The numbers are probably higher now, but there has been an outbreak of chikungunya fever, another virus, in the Caribbean. And there's been, I think now, over 2,000 cases on multiple islands. So people who vacation in that area as well are going to be at risk. This is also an infection with a short incubation period and very similar to dengue in that you get fever, joint pain, a rash. You can have low white blood cell counts, low platelets. And when I say liver, that's elevated liver function tests or liver inflammation. People can have severe complications, and there was a huge outbreak in India a number of years ago, and there were a lot of deaths in elderly patients in that area. Diagnostic testing here is similar as I showed you with dengue, where you can do antibody testing with that IgM and IgG, and several labs are able to do this. Sometimes you can send it to the CDC, and they'll help out, or a local lab called Quest Diagnostics, which probably a lot of you are familiar with, actually has a test. All right, so dengue fever, a common infection. I think you guys have a sense of the epidemiology and clinical manifestations. Let's do another case. This is a guy I saw several years ago, a 63-year-old guy. He was coming back from a 10-day vacation to South Africa. His complaints were fevers, myalgias, and rash. And this is a picture that he had shared with me. He was going hunting, and this is an animal that he had killed on his hunt.
Why do we not want to know that animal?
Yes. Not here, Judge.
Why aren't you showing the eyes?
What's that?
Why aren't you showing the eyes?
Well, I tend to not show my patients' eyes as a way of not de-identifying them. And the reason I didn't show the animals was to make a joke. But it didn't go over very well, I guess. My humor's subtle. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about his history. So he left San Francisco Bay Area, traveled to South Africa, spent about eight days there on a hunting trip, and then he came back to the U.S. And he was feeling fine on his flight back. But then the next day, he started developing fevers, aches, fatigue. And then another day or two later, he noticed this lesion around his right waistband. And I'll show you some pictures of it. Over a couple more days, he just started developing red spots on his arms and his chest. And then he came, when I saw him several days after that, in the UCSF emergency department. And what I didn't say here, though, is he did see his primary care doctor, who knew the patient had traveled to South Africa, and very thoughtfully did some testing, did some blood cultures, did some smears to look for malaria, and started a workup for a fever in a returning traveler. So when we saw this patient in the emergency room, looked a little exhausted, had a temperature of 101, but other vital signs were normal, and noticed that he had a 1 centimeter right inguinal lymph node that was swollen. So LAD is lymphadenopathy, swollen lymph node, and it was a little bit tender. And then let me show you some pictures. So this is a blown up image of this original lesion he had, this little ulceration. You can see it's kind of a little bit scooped out. And then he had this rash, all these little raised red dots. They were all over his chest, and he had some on his back and some on his head. So as I said, he had some work done to kind of help identify it. And I showed you that the most common cause of fever in a returning traveler from sub-Saharan Africa is malaria, right? So as I said, he had malaria smear done, was negative. He had a bunch of blood tests done that all looked pretty normal, and he had blood cultures, so taking some blood out of you to look for bacteria, that was negative as well. But let's think about, again, using the data that we have available, and think about a returning traveler from sub-Saharan Africa. So as I said, malaria is the most common, but you can say rickettsia infection, a type of bacteria, was the second most common, although a very distant second. This guy came back and got sick about one day after he returned, right? So incubation period, probably very short. So probably not these guys, but now we're thinking about dengue and rickettsia. So a bunch of these pieces are starting to fall together to suggest that maybe rickettsia is a likely thing. And that's indeed what he had. He had African tick bite fever, which I'll tell you a little bit more about, which is a type of rickettsia. And rickettsia is a very small intracellular bacteria, and you can see these here. They like to live within cells, and they're most frequently transmitted by insects. And most of them are transmitted by ticks, but some of them are transmitted by other insects. So as I said, he had African tick bite fever. And African tick bite fever is transmitted by the African bont tick. Pretty little guy there. And it's really, this tick is endemic through much of sub-Saharan Africa. And they're very aggressive ticks. They tend to be a number of them together. And it's not uncommon for when people get a bite, they actually get multiple bites. You can see his exposure. So where they like to live is they like to live on the grass, and they like to live on ungulates, which are types of cattle, et cetera, and animals like this. So it's very likely that these ticks were hanging out on this guy, and after he killed them, and maybe kind of just crawled over and down his pants. As I said, I'm not here to judge. So clinical presentation, so how do people present with this illness? Much like him, fever, headache, muscle aches, these small ulcerations, regional lymph node swelling, and they can frequently see a rash. And this is actually another patient who I saw even more recently who came in with very similar symptoms. And you can see his, what we call these eschars or inoculation ulcers. This is the site of the tick bite, was actually between his fingers right there. So it could be a little bit harder to find. I also, not too long ago, had a patient who had the rash, the fever, traveled to the right area, didn't have malaria, and we were really suspicious of this diagnosis and had trouble, but said, well, there's no ulcer. And actually what she ended up having was her ulcer was right at the inner part of her underwear came in, and unless you really like looked at that area very closely, you would have missed the ulceration. So you can really, although you won't think that the ticks can get into your clothes, there are times when they are able to do that. This is one of the terminology for these ulcers, is a tache noire. So treatment, so these are a very satisfying diagnosis to make, and I'll tell you why, is that you give these guys antibiotics, and doxycycline, which a lot of you might have heard about, is actually very effective and works very quickly. And literally, like, these are one of these diagnoses that you, most infections that you know that you're treating with the right antibiotic, it still takes several days before people are really feeling a lot better. This, like one dose and 95% better. So very a satisfying diagnosis to make. All right, so another case. So this is a 28-year-old guy who returned 3 weeks ago. He was in Kenya. This is actually a medical student doing research. And last week he reported he developed a fever up to 103. He had occasional hives, which I think you guys are probably familiar with as a type of rash. Had some cough and wheezing, and this is where he was studying in Kisumu, Kenya. When we saw him on exam, he had a fever up to 101 as well. He had some wheezing in his lungs, and he had a bit of a rash. And one of the things that were interesting in his lab results that really stood out as being abnormal was he had an elevated eosinophil count. And so there's, when we talk about white blood cells in your blood, there are lots of different types of white blood cells, and you know, evolutionarily, there's each one of them has kind of been designed to fight a different type of infection. Our neutrophils here are really good at attacking bacteria. Some of our lymphocytes are really good for viruses. But when we see elevation in eosinophil count, these are the ones which we don't use so much anymore, living where we live, but those have kind of been designed to fight off parasitic infections. So when you see an elevated eosinophil count, you're tending to think, well, I'm a little bit worried that this patient might have a parasitic infection. When we do see elevated eosinophil count here in the U.S., actually most often with what we're seeing is allergic responses, because that's the other thing that the eosinophils are responding to, are allergies. And here in the U.S., that's probably most likely what you're seeing, or some sort of allergic reaction. So when we talked to the patient about their exposures, he said he swam in a freshwater lake. And he had noted during his trip that when he swam in the lake, he developed an itchy rash with lots of little bumps. He reported no uncooked food. He drank only bottled water, denied any exposure to sick contacts, and his sexual activity was really only with his girlfriend. And here's an image, which I think you can see a lot of these little tiny bumps. And I'll show it to you in a little bit more detail. And so these are actually photos that he had taken on his trip, and he thought it was very unusual. So as I said, when I think about, when I see somebody with eosinophilia, I really think about in parasitic infections. Interestingly, here in California, probably when we do see an infection related to eosinophilia, Valley fever, which I think you guys have probably, a lot of you heard about, which is also termed as coccidiomycosis, which is a fungus. It's a very unusual that a fungus does this, actually does cause eosinophilia. But in a returning traveler, you're going to be thinking about worms. So what did this patient have? This patient had something called schistosomiasis. And schistosomiasis is a type of worm that lives in freshwater. And what happens is it swims in the water and penetrates into your skin. And have you guys ever heard of swimmer's itch before? Okay. So swimmer's itch is actually a common condition that you'd see in lakes like Wisconsin, for example, would be a place that has swimmer's itch is common. And what that is actually schistosomiasis, but for birds. And they've evolved only be able to cause to penetrate to the skin and cause a reaction there, but they aren't able to get any farther. But the schistosomiasis that this patient has is able to get into the skin and cause that initial rash, this swimmer's itch, but then is able to get into the rest of the body and cause all sorts of trouble. So as I said, swimmer's itch happens when these little worms penetrate the skin, happen within the first day after exposure. Then later on, what our patient is having is, and happens even a month afterwards, is your body's very robust immune response to having these eggs kind of going from larva up into worms and kind of growing on their own. And that's where you get this big eosinophil response. And your immune system is so hyped up when it sees all these. That's why the patient had a rash and had some wheezing and fever. Ultimately, what happens is these little worms, they come in different flavors and they like different parts of the body. So some will go into your gut, some will go into the bladder, some will go into the liver, and they can cause inflammation and problems over a long period of time. This type of infection predominates mostly in sub-Saharan Africa and some parts of Asia, but not a lot in other parts of the world. And the way that we make these the diagnosis in this case is we do a microbiological analysis. We actually get some stool, and this is an O&P, is a stool looking for ova and parasites. And so you actually will get some stool for the ones that spend time in the gut, and you'll look at it under the microscope. You'll kind of clean out the stool and look at it. Or you also look at a urine for ova and parasites. So as I said, some of them like to go to the bladder, and you can look under there for them. You can also look for antibodies, so looking at the body's immune response. We talked before about dengue, which is a virus, but your body also makes antibodies to these types of parasites, and you can look for it that way. Or you can do a biopsy, and you can look at under the microscope of your own tissue and see if it's kind of embedded in there. Treatments are usually with anti-parasitic agents. And in a patient like this who came in with such a robust immune response to the infection, although steroids we tend to think of as putting you at risk for infection,
sometimes we'll actually give patients like this steroids to kind of tell their immune system to cool down, stop causing all the symptoms, and then treat them with the parasitic infection, antiparasitics. Because if you give them antiparasitics, it kind of lets the insides of the worms come out, and it'll just rile up your immune system more, and you can really make you feel pretty horrible. All right. Next case is a shorter case, another febrile returning traveler or a febrile traveler. This is a 45-year-old Russian businessman who came to San Francisco. He came to urgent care with fever and rash for several days. He also had a cough, nasal congestion, and some itchy eyes. And he had been in San Francisco for 1 week. He was here for a conference. Otherwise, had no other medical problems that he reports. Hadn't really been taking any medications, and this is what he looked like. Okay. So any thoughts of what this is? Measles. I heard somebody say it. Yeah, so this is measles. All right. So although you might think that we've done a good job of eradicating measles, and we have more or less here in the U.S., but people in other countries, that there are continuously outbreaks in other parts of the world. And if you look at the data of, you know, measles in the U.S., we've actually been having increasing in cases, over the last decade. And one, this is often people returning from other parts of the world with this infection. But every once in a while, there'll be a population or a community here in the U.S., who have not gotten vaccinated appropriately. And then they can start off our own little mini outbreak here. So when I think about evaluating somebody for travel, and you think about all these vaccines that you give for hepatitis or Japanese encephalitis or all these other kind of rare things, you want to first start by making sure that you've vaccinated them for the more common diseases and make sure that they don't get those. So this next case is a 35-year-old guy who presents with a fever, and he returned 2 weeks ago from a 3-week trip to Ghana. He received hepatitis A vaccine, typhoid vaccine, yellow fever vaccine, all before travel as recommended, did a good job of drinking bottled water, cooked his food, paying close attention to preparation. And he used treated bed nets and used DEET on his skin, but decided not to take malaria prophylaxis. When he returned, his main complaint was fever, and on exam, he looked kind of pretty beat up. It looked like he'd been having fever for a number of days, but there was really no other focal abnormalities on exam. And we drew some blood tests on him, and he had a low red blood cell count, okay? And he had a mild elevation in his bilirubin, which can be suggestive of something going on in the liver, or actually, when you break down red blood cells, actually red blood cells, you can get elevation in your bilirubin. And so he had a malaria smear done, and this is what we call a thick smear, where we just kind of lyse all the red blood cells, and we just look. It allows you to really take a really good look to see if there's anything in there. And you could see that there were a bunch of these kind of forms. So what we do to make an idea, so this helps us identify whether there is a parasite in there. And then we do something called a thin smear to really do a better job of identifying what the organism itself is. And so what these little rings, this is a normal red blood cell. Okay. They're supposed to look like this. There's not supposed to be anything inside. And what you're seeing inside here is malaria. So this is Plasmodium falciparum. And as I said, a very common, cause of fever in a returning traveler. So where do we see, what are risk areas for malaria? So it's really kind of the tropical, subtropical regions, sub-Saharan Africa. This is kind of South America in tropical regions, like where Amazon is. We do have it in some parts of Mexico, Central America. Dominican Republic may have some, but definitely Haiti. There were outbreaks, particularly in people that were going to do service work after the earthquake, and in Haitians itself. And then in Indian subcontinent, Southeast Asia, were all areas that are at risk for malaria. So the CDC is usually about 2 years behind when they publish data on different diseases. And this is their data that was published in 2013, but it was the 2011 malaria data. And what it shows here, this is the number of malaria cases in some, and this is broken down by species. And the one that's most severe and is Plasmodium falciparum. but there's some other species. But the point I want you to get out of this is that there was increase in the number of cases for that four-year period. And if you think back to like the second or third slide I showed you, that there's been an increase in the number of travelers, you know, over the last however many decades, and there's going to continue to be an increase. So it's not surprising that we're seeing more and more malaria. So how does malaria present? Signs and symptoms, fever being the most common, but chills, sweats, headache. Sometimes people have nausea and vomiting, aches, just overall feeling exhausted. Sometimes on exam, they'll have an enlarged spleen. So your spleen's on your left, your liver's here on the right. And you can see sometimes enlargement in both of those. Sometimes you can have really severe disease and malaria kills. And that's why when I said that a returning traveler who has a fever, particularly who's gone to an area where malaria is endemic, you want to make sure that you send them to a hospital right away to get evaluated, because you'd want to start them on treatment for malaria right away if that was a diagnosis. People can go on to develop problems with their brain, coma, seizure. They can have severe anemia, kidney failure, fluid in their lungs, blood in their urine, and they can get actually up to over 5% of their red blood cells all infected with malaria. When you have high rates, more than 5%, it can be really severe. So how do we prevent malaria? So if you're going to a lower risk area, usually what I'll focus on is insect avoidance. So using those things like DEET, permethrin, trying to stay in an air conditioning at night. But if somebody who has a lot of other medical conditions, if somebody who is visiting friends and relatives, and so there's this category of, it's called VFR, so people visiting friends and relatives in developing countries tend to be at higher risk for things like this. Prolonged travel, so even if your exposure risk is low, but you're going to be there for a month, that's additive, so sometimes we'll do it then. Or if somebody's going to have unreliable access to medical care, so somebody who's actually going to a very remote area and there's no way they can get help, then that might be somebody I might give them chemoprophylaxis, so that medication to prevent malaria. Anybody going to a moderate high-risk area tend to give it. So I thought I'd explain, because malaria is so common and you guys probably hear a lot about it, I thought I would go over a little bit of the life cycle of malaria, explain to you a little bit how the infection works, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the preventative medications that people get. So I think it's going to explain why we give it for so long afterwards in a lot of the cases. So I made this myself. Yes, it's pretty awesome, I know. So hopefully you can tell that that's a mosquito. Not a dripping Y, but that's a mosquito. Bites the skin. And this form of the parasite, the malaria, the sporozoite, goes into the liver. Okay? So it doesn't, although we think about it in the red blood cells, it actually starts by going from the skin into the liver. And it hangs out there, matures, changes forms. And then it's actually not for 1 to 2 weeks after you get that initial bite before it gets out into the bloodstream. And then once it gets in the bloodstream, it has a great time. You can see these ring. You remember that ring formed I show you, which is called a trophozoite. It replicates. It bursts open the red blood cell, and that's why you get anemia, is because after it reproduces, it busts open the red blood cell, and then it goes and it infects a whole bunch more red blood cells. And the cycle continues, and you get more and more infected red blood cells. So if you think about our medications for prevention, the majority of them really focus on this stage, okay? One of the medications, etovacone proguanil, which we'll talk a little bit about the medications in a second, actually has some activity against the liver. And that's why when we talk about how long you take it after you go somewhere, you'll understand. But what I want to emphasize is, if you're taking a preventative medication that is active on the blood phase, but you get infected the day that you leave, and you stop taking the medication after your day on the plane, well, it's going to be hanging out in your liver for 1 or 2 weeks, totally protected from getting any of this to prevent it. And then it's going to be the 2 weeks later when it breaks out into your red blood cells, into your bloodstream. There's not going to be any preventative medication around. And then you're going to go on to get yourself into trouble. So these are the most common preventative medications that we give. Etovacone proguanil, also known as Malarone. is an excellent medication. It's really able to be used in all parts of the world. And as I showed you, it has activity against the liver phase also. So that's why you only need to take it 1 week after you leave a risk area. Whereas chloroquine, doxycycline, and mefloquine, these other ones I'm going to talk about, only are active on the blood phase. So you need to take them for a month afterwards to be extra safe. I know I showed you 2 weeks, but you know we're conservative. So these are some of the medications. This one tends to be more expensive, but very well tolerated. Chloroquine used to be the standard medication, but there's resistance in almost all parts of the world except for west and north of the Panama Canal. So it's pretty much Central America and the Caribbean. You can still use this. Doxycycline, which we talked about before for rickettsial infections, also has activity against malaria. But a lot of people have issues with photosensitivity because it can make you like sunburn. So somebody who's very fair, like myself, who gets sunburned anyways, would be in a lot of trouble. Some people get an upset stomach with it. And mefloquine is one that there's also a small area in the world on the Thai-Cambodian border where there's resistance to this. So you wouldn't want to take it if you're going there. You take it for a month afterwards. It's the only one that we can use for prevention in pregnant women, we know it's safe in very young children. And this is the one that you maybe heard about that gives you the funny dreams that are associated with it. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the other medical problems that you see now that we kind of moved on past what I think is the most fun thing to talk about, which is fever. I'm going to talk about now the most common, which is traveler's diarrhea. Traveler's diarrhea, as I said, is the number one cause of illness in a returning traveler. And the most common pathogens or things that cause this are bacteria. And certain ones are like E. coli, which you may have heard about. There's different types of E. coli. There's some that are normally live in your GI tract. And then there's some that can cause problems like the ones that cause this. Campylobacter, Shigella, Salmonella are ones. And then some viruses. So norovirus, you guys have probably heard about. This is the one that on those classically on the cruise ships that go just kind of spread through the whole cruise ship and everybody's having diarrhea. I'm glad I'm not been on one of those. Rotavirus is a virus that particularly in children causes diarrhea. So the course of illness in traveler's diarrhea tends to be relatively short. I'm sure it's easy for me to say that right now when you're not in the middle of having diarrhea every day, probably seems like an eternity. But relatively speaking, usually it's limited to 3 to 5 days. People get better and it's over. They need to make sure they stay hydrated. And people who tend to come back and have diarrhea for longer, we tend to think about non-bacterial causes, which I'll mention in a minute. The way that we do prevention is we tell people to avoid contaminated food and water. There's actually studies that show if you take Pepto-Bismol 2 tablets 4 times a day, it can prevent it. Now, I almost dare anybody to go on a travel and take 2 tabs of Pepto-Bismol 4 times a day to prevent traveler's diarrhea. There's also an antibiotic out there that there's some studies that show that you can prevent it from doing that. And I recommend this in rare cases, particularly people who have abnormal immune systems or other problems. What I usually do is I usually give people to have them fill a prescription for one or another antibiotics to take at the onset of diarrhea, because there's nice studies showing that 3 to 5 day illness of diarrhea can really be taken down to a 1, 1.5 day illness if you take antibiotics. So ciprofloxacin is one I give. Azithromycin is actually given quite commonly, particularly when they go to Southeast Asia, because there's a lot of ciprofloxacin resistance. Also for children and pregnant women, we don't give ciprofloxacin, so we tend to use that. Rifaximin is actually a pretty cool newer antibiotic that is non-absorbed, so you don't get any systemic absorption of this antibiotic, so it stays in your gut only where that's where you need it. And then loperamide, Imodium, you can use it in cases. I tend to find that people really suffer a lot from constipation afterwards. So, but if you're about ready to get on a bus, plane, train, and you have traveler's diarrhea, what I recommend is taking the antibiotic and taking loperamide because there are studies showing that that combination is more helpful. So moving on, I'm going to talk a little bit about some skin conditions that we see. And this is one of the most common skin conditions that we see in returning travelers. So see this serpiginous line on the person's foot, it's actually serpiginous because there's a worm in there. So this is something that's called cutaneous larva migrans. And as I said, it is a very common cause of skin problems in a returning traveler. And a little bit like similar to how we talked about the schistosomiasis before with the swimmer's itch. And as I said, that was like duck schistosomiasis. It only got into the skin, but it didn't cause all the other problems because it was really for ducks. Well, what this is actually cat and dog hookworm. And very similar, there's human hookworm that will go into your skin and then go up into your lungs and GI tract. However, this animal one, all it can do is get in the skin and it can't get any farther. So that's what happens is these worms get in under the skin and eventually they'll die after a week or two, but you will have a wiggly worm underneath your skin for that period of time. You're not going to feel it wiggling around, but you'll see the red mark. What I'll frequently do is give people anti-parasitic medications, and it'll kill it and shorten the course. This is actually someone who got it on their hand because what happens is the dogs, most common it's dogs, and people will go on the beach and the dogs will defecate on the beach and then people will walk barefoot. And the what they do is they penetrate into your feet from underneath and then they go around. But sometimes with kids, you'll see it. It's like the kids will be playing on the sand, building sandcastles, and so you can see it on the hands as well. So prevention is wearing shoes, not putting your hand in the sand. But how many people wear shoes on the beach? You know, come on. So another type of infection in a returning traveler. So I'm going to show you a couple of these different kinds. Next thing I'm going to show you is a bunch of the same type of infection. Show you lots of different variations of it. So this was a returning traveler I saw coming back from Panama who had had this evolving lesion on his foot for many weeks. This is another one of my patients who had a similar disease process on his nose, and he had been in Costa Rica for quite a period of time. This is a patient of mine who had had been in Portugal and had this is actually, you can see a different, this is the same disease but looks a bit different. Someone who had it on their arm and someone who had it on their leg. So what is this? This is cutaneous leishmaniasis. So cutaneous leishmaniasis is one form of a type of parasitic infection called leishmaniasis, and it comes really in three flavors. So visceral leishmaniasis, which usually infects the inside, your viscera, spleen, liver, bone marrow, your cutaneous, which can infect your nose or other parts of your skin, or mucosal, which can affect your up in your mouth, your palate, and sometimes can erode your nose. So where do you get this? So what I see most commonly is cutaneous, and I would say most people that we see are returning from Central or South America, but you can get it in sub-Saharan Africa. We tend to see military personnel returning from the Middle East who get it. You can see these larger blue dots here, but you can even have it in some parts of Europe. You can get this as well. How do you get it? So this is a sandfly. So most of what I've talked about today is you get from a mosquito, but you can actually get this from a sandfly. And clinical manifestations of this, usually there's a delay of 1 week to a month before you start seeing a little raised bump, and then it ulcerates over time. And it can get as big as I showed you. It can get quite big. And mostly these are not painful lesions, and they get better by themselves. But particularly you can see some of these people had really bad disease. They want this improved as quickly as possible. This mucosal disease, as I said, even many years after your skin lesion may have gone away, you may get it in the nose or the mouth and can be quite devastating. So how do you make a diagnosis? What usually happens is the way that you figure out that you have a lesion you're concerned about, and you can either do a skin biopsy or you can actually stick a needle in the edge of this big ulcer and aspirate out some fluid. And what we do is we actually often will send it to our colleagues at the CDC, and they have a super lab there that they'll do culturing or other specialized testing. treatment tends to be very complicated for this disease because it depends on the species, how extensive your disease is. When I say comorbidities, because there's a lot of these treatments are very toxic, if you have a lot of other medical problems, it can be hard to treat. So our options in these cases are no treatment. Sometimes we give topical treatment. Sometimes we'll actually give injections of some of this medication. And every once in a while, we'll give systemic therapy. But unfortunately, a lot of the systemic therapies that are given through an IV most commonly have a lot of side effects. But I want to show you that these people do get better, as bad as it looks. I didn't want you to leave feeling very upset. So this guy, after treatment, much better. This guy, much better on his nose, sent me a selfie. Forehead lesion. You can see this is a not related to the infection, but you can see that got a lot better. Arm lesion, much better. So I wanted you to see that, you know, we can treat these types of infections, but if you are returning from an area that has these, that you're at risk for this and you see a skin lesion, you do want to kind of consider this in your what we call differential diagnosis. So some other skin lesions that might bug your patients. So this is a returning traveler that looks like they just have some pimples on their arm after returning from an Amazonian trek. Looks a little less like a pimple at that point. And this is actually what gets pulled out. This is what we call a botfly infection. Okay. And botfly infections, these very sneaky flies actually deposit their eggs on mosquitoes and make the mosquitoes do their work. And the mosquitoes are what bite you and then deposit the fly eggs and larvae in there. This is another one. This is a researcher who is returning from Ethiopia and has had these painful skin lesions on the bottom of their feet. And this is something similar. This is called tungiasis. Tunga penetrans. So instead of it being a fly, these are little fleas that will climb up into your foot and then they're pregnant and then they release eggs out of your foot and so they can spread their eggs all around and eventually will come out about after a month. So a couple other syndromes to think about, and I'm going to finish up talking about two more. Chronic diarrhea tends to be a common thing we see. And these are due to usually parasitic, or the type of parasite is protozoal infection. Probably the most common one being Giardia, which you guys probably a lot of you have heard about before. And there's a couple other called Cryptosporidium and Entamoeba. And this is a picture of Giardia. Everybody loves Giardia, don't they? See, they're very cute. They look like they have two little eyes and a face. How do we evaluate somebody when they come back? We usually, although it's less common to be bacteria, we do a stool culture usually for bacteria. And then what we do is we examine the stool for parasites. And so this is stool that was examined, and it had something called Entamoeba histolytica. This is intestinal amoebiasis, and this is the parasite that causes that. And then probably the last and one of the more common complaints I will see in my clinic is people who return with not diarrhea, but kind of complaining of stomach upset and other kind of gastrointestinal complaints. And the things we think about in those are some of these more larger worms. What the other ones I was showing you about are protozoa, which are single cell. But the worms tend to not really cause diarrhea, but they can cause local invasion into the gut, and they can give you an upset stomach. So we think about some of them called strongyloides, schistosomiasis, which I mentioned, Ascaris, or which some of those classic really large worms. Sometimes it's just gastritis, but maybe you guys have heard of Helicobacter pylori infection. People can acquire that overseas, hepatitis, or not infrequently constipation. And when we've worked somebody up for all these different types of processes, what some of them end up having is what we call post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome, which is nobody really understands what irritable bowel syndrome is, but it's probably something related to after you had the infection, a change in the normal bacterial flora causes some sort of dysregulation, and people can have some constipation, loose stools, some cramping, gas, and it often will go away for after a couple months, but may last longer. So I'm going to wrap up here with my tour through ill returning travelers, and I think I'll take some questions. Yes?
You mentioned that there are probably results from changing climate around the world. and intense heat and possibly wet, how is it going to affect your business? And how would it affect you returning from those areas?
So I think your question is how is climate change going to affect ill-returning travelers? Or I guess what I would say is, I mean, I think from my very lay understanding of climate change and seem like it's getting warmer, I think a lot of the vectors that we're going to be worried about that are probably going to be moving to colder climates, and I wouldn't be surprised if at some point things like chikungunya and dengue. I mean, dengue in particular, actually, I didn't talk about this, but there was an outbreak even that was self-sustaining in southern Florida at one point. So, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if we see more of those kind of vector-borne diseases farther north. Yeah?
They say that they have West Nile virus in San Francisco now. Do you see a lot of cases?
So the question was about West Nile virus. So West Nile virus, also a mosquito-borne illness, and it's the most common mosquito-borne illness in the U.S. I'm not familiar with much in San Francisco itself. We definitely see a lot of cases in California, but more commonly in kind of Central Valley area are the hotter spots. But there are, I mean, the California Department of Public Health has a very nice West Nile virus website. And actually, when I'm thinking about that diagnosis in a patient, I will frequently go to their website and look, because not only will they tell you about human cases, they'll tell you about a number of bird cases as well, because that's usually, you're going to see more bird cases before you see human cases, and it will give me a sense if that's something I should be worried about in that patient.
Once you have malaria, is it COVID curable?
So the question was, is malaria curable? And so there's a couple different forms of malaria. If you're treated appropriately with, like, for example, with the Plasmodium falciparum, which is the most common one, it's definitely curable. A couple of the other forms, one called Plasmodium vivax and one called Plasmodium ovale, can actually stay latent in the liver. So you actually have to give another type of medication to clear that out. But sometimes if that's not cleared out appropriately, you can have it come back later. But for the most part, they're all curable if they're treated appropriately.
Yeah, I thought Epstein-Barr virus was caused by prolonged kissing. What does that have to do with foreign travel? And then another one that's specifically about foreign travel. The other set of question I have is when I've traveled before to countries that might give you bacterial diarrhea, my internist would give me Cipro to take. But last time I asked him, and he says, no, I don't want to give you that because it actually can cause an infection with Clostridium difficile. So I just don't understand why should or should not one be able to have Cipro and take it on the onset of diarrhea.
Two good questions. So I'm going to answer the question about Epstein-Barr virus. So Epstein-Barr virus is also sometimes known as the kissing disease. And that's really one of the ways it's transmitted is through saliva. And, you know, it happens to happen in teenagers. So that's not an uncommon mode of transmission. Now, why do travelers get it? So probably if you looked at the rate of Epstein-Barr virus infection among our population here locally, it's probably going to be 80%. 85% in adults. Whereas if you went to a lot of these other parts of the world, it's probably closer to 95 to 100%. And people shed all the time. So particularly if you're if you're having interaction with if you're one of those people that has not been infected and your interaction with a population that tends to have a higher infection rate, your risk of getting infection is higher. Don't tell me. Okay, Cipro. Okay. So the question regarding – I think that's an excellent question in the sense that every time we give antibiotics, we have to think about risk-benefit ratio. And there are risks of giving antibiotics, and I think your primary care provider is very thoughtful. And there is a risk of Clostridium difficile infection, which is a bacterial infection that people can get from – taking antibiotics. Essentially, it clears out that normal good bacteria when you take an antibiotic. and can sometimes allow some of these other resistant bacteria to flourish as if you kind of knock out the competition. And so I think your provider is saying, well, I'm trying to weigh the risk-benefit of those. I mean, I think the risk, the individual person-specific risk of getting Clostridium difficile infection from taking ciprofloxacin is low. But one way to potentially reduce that is maybe giving you something like rifaximin. Rifaximin probably is active against Clostridium difficile infection itself, and has a much lower risk rate, and so it might be an alternative.
Have you ever had any of these things? And if not, which of these do you have the most fear of?
Have I had any of these types of infections before? And what do I fear the most? Yeah. Let's see. What have I had? What type of infections have I had? I have not had most of these. And what do I fear the most? I'm not sure I'm going to answer this question. Yeah.
If you're taking antibiotics, does it make any sense to load up with probiotics?
So the question was, is what is the benefit of using probiotics when you're on antibiotics? I think it's a really good question. So probiotics are one of these treatments that I think that keeps getting studied over and over again and has not really been demonstrated very well to do a whole lot. Now, there was a study that showed that if you took probiotics while you're taking antibiotics, it does reduce the risk of what we call antibiotic-associated diarrhea, different than Clostridium difficile infection. So I don't think it harms, but remember that most probiotics you're going to take contain one, maybe two bacteria in it. So how many different bacteria are in your gut? I mean, there are numerous, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different species in there. So it's a very complex environment. So I think that reintroducing one or two different species in there when you have a very complex process going on, you know, you can imagine that maybe it's not going to have that tremendous benefit that you think. But I don't think it's necessarily harmful. And as I said, there are some studies that say it may reduce risk. So
is there some explanation as to why this 45-year-old man got measles while traveling? Is it the stress of travel? Is it the change?
There was an outbreak locally at his home in Russia. And then he happened to travel. There's nothing more to it than that, but they're having a local outbreak. Sorry, I'm going to take your question, sir, and then I'll get to the other guys.
I suppose as an infectious disease physician that just seeing patients, you're more exposed to these conditions than you would otherwise be, or we are likely to be if we aren't traveling. Is that true?
The question is, am I exposed to infections? And the simple answer is probably yes. But I'll tell you, most of my patients who come in with infections are predisposed because of other abnormalities in their immune system. Usually, I see a lot of patients who are immunosuppressed because they're taking medications for a transplant or they're taking medication for some other disease process where the benefit of reducing their immune system helps treat the disease. So most of the things that I see them infected with, I'm probably not at risk from because my immune system is normal. I will also see people who have artificial things put in them. They may have a prosthetic knee or a prosthetic hip, and that may get infected, and so or related to surgery. You know, these things are important. I mean, the risk of infection in these are low, and I don't want anyone, again, to think that those aren't things that you should get, but rarely we will see infections related to different types of surgery, so that may be a predisposing risk. But I personally have I wash my hands before and after I see all my patients. If I have somebody who comes in with influenza or other respiratory viruses, I make sure they wear a mask and I wear a mask. But I don't have much concern for the most part.
Okay. And what is the overlap between your specialty and that of dermatology with these skin types?
Yeah. So my specialty, I see infections of all parts of the body. Dermatologists tend to focus on the skin, and so we'll see infections that are related to skin. And I work very, very closely with my dermatology colleagues, and we are frequently referring patients back and forth to each other because I'll have patients with a lesion. I ask them to do a biopsy. They all they think about is the skin all day, and they're very expert in that, where I think about lots of different parts of the body.
So that would be, I mean, I saw some of those skin infections. If you didn't have other symptoms,
and a lot of those skin things, they do see the dermatologist first, and I, as I said, I work closely with them. Did you have a question? I'm sorry.
I have a question about two things. Just my mother got to a dermatologist first, terrible itching on her hands. We don't know what it is. Then you'll be happy to hear that she got the same diagnosis at the Stanford Skin Clinic. Oh, it's all on your head and stuff. She finally got to the third dermatologist. He said scabies, because it's not here. But it took her three dermatologists and a Stanford dermatologist. Anyway, my question is, I get blood, and you have to fill out all these questions, and I can't remember specifically what they are, but have you been in the last 4 years to a country that has da-da-da-da-da?
Why are they asking that? Is that your question?
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're looking for infection risk. So, you know, I think some of the questions they ask are, you been to an area that's endemic for malaria, particularly I was asked before, some of these types of malaria can live for a longer period of time, and so they can present later. So that's some of the reasons they ask.
Thank you.
Sure. Yes?
Yeah, I'm going to Africa in early June, which I get all these medicines.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question was, when should you present to for pre-travel evaluation? And, you know, I think if you think about how long it can take some of the vaccines, like, you know, really the most for the preparation of some of these series, like Japanese encephalitis, which you're not going to need in Africa, or rabies, which, depending on what you're going to go to, may not be at risk. I mean, I think if you go a full month ahead of time, that should be plenty.
Do people who live in some of the areas that we can travel to have better immunity than we would because they live there, or is it really about what kind of health anybody has, no matter where they are?
I guess the question is, are people protected against some of these infections locally because they're exposed to them all the time? And the answer is yes. I mean, there is some immunity to malaria. Your body is able to make some sort of immune response to it. So a totally naive person who's never seen it probably is going to get sicker than somebody who's been infected multiple times. But yeah.
Would you advise against eating locally fermented foods? Because his question about probiotics made me think, because I've read things about fermented foods are really good for increasing your intestinal flora and keeping you healthy. But then I was thinking, so if you went to South America, maybe you should eat there locally fermented foods, but then maybe you shouldn't because you're not using.
Yeah, I don't know. It depends on the preparation process, but I don't know. Going to a developing country and eating food. Yeah, I mean, I love kimchi, but it seems like if you had choices, that might not be high in the list of things I want to eat.
What fermented foods are you thinking about? What are they?
Yogurt,
sourdough bread.
Yeah, breads are fine. I mean, beer's always good. Yes?
On a tour in India, when anyone came down with a traveler's diarrhea, the tour guide brought up yogurt and psyllium. Mix it together, and in an hour, everyone was...
I haven't tried that before, but it sounds like we should check it out. Yeah, great. That's good.
Psyllium.
All right. So, okay, one more. Yeah, yeah.
So about rabies.
Yes.
So what's the process with rabies? Because my understanding is if you're actually bitten, I was an Indian, bitten my dog. What they said was, you have two choices. Either get the whole series of shots now, or you wait 2 years to see if you're going to develop rabies. What's the whole process?
Sure. So I'd be happy to talk about that. So Rabies prevention, there's two ways to prevent rabies. So there's one that we call pre-exposure prophylaxis. So a preventative strategy that is before you get bit. Okay, so that's pre-exposure. And the second one is what we call post-exposure prophylaxis. So getting preventative treatment after you, say, get bit. We'll use that as the example. So we know that the rabies vaccine, when given, can make protective antibodies against the virus. But it takes time for that to work, okay? You know, as I showed you before with, like, that dengue serology, the IgG takes some time to make and be effective. So if you're vaccinated, you want to be vaccinated and have your immune system able to make antibodies effectively before you get bit. So if you're going to try to get that all ready and get your immune system ready to handle a rabies exposure, you want to take what we call pre-exposure prophylaxis, or a series of three shots, day 0, day 7, day 21, before you travel. And then if you were to be bit by a rabid animal, you would then get some additional vaccines to boost your immune system. But your immune system would have already been able to identify rabies if it got into your body and attack. And you're just giving some other vaccine to boost. Now, if you had never been vaccinated and you were bitten by a dog, what you would do is do post-exposure prophylaxis. And because you don't have pre-prepared antibodies that are ready to attack rabies, and you want to get it really fast because rabies is bad, you get something called rabies immune globulin. And essentially what that is antibodies preformed that attack rabies, and you'll get injected into your skin, and it'll go and hunt out and find the rabies. And then you'll get vaccinated as well. So while you're waiting for those 2 weeks for your body's immune system to know how to fight rabies, you're given something that is actually those antibodies already, so it can clear it out. Does that make sense? So one of the limitations to a lot of developing countries is, although you might be able to get the rabies vaccine, If you're exposed there and you had not gotten those vaccine ahead of time, they don't have, rabies immune globulin. So if you can't get that and you only get the vaccine, you're not going to be protected early on. So when I have travelers that are going to go to high-risk areas or doing high-risk activities, I really encourage them to get the pre-exposure prophylaxis if they're going to go to a place where they can't get rabies immune globulin. Does that make sense? I know it's kind of a complicated concept, but okay.
And it's only by getting bitten that you consider an exposure?
There are a number of ways to get rabies. Bites probably being the most common, but not always just dogs, bats. But usually, if you got licked on an open wound, that would, but.
And is that true that if you don't do any, if you decide not to take the shots or whatever, and it's 2 years until it appears?
Rabies can have a prolonged incubation period. Remember, we talked about incubation at the beginning, but it can have a shorter incubation period. And I think if you have a rabies exposure, I think you're kind of a knucklehead if you don't get post-exposure prophylaxis.
I'm really asking for my cat. We have a cat whose back legs are paralyzed, who is like Charles Atlas because she's never been put in a wheelchair. We take her up to our cabin in Idaho, and we've never given her a rabies shot. The other cats get them because we never thought she'd get a bat. Last summer, she caught a bat.
I'm going to say that I don't do animals, and I'm going to end on that note. I will be happy to hang around a little bit to take other questions. Okay.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.